This is January 28th, 2018, and for the show today I'm going to be talking about memory and forgetting. This is another topic that for which I've had articles piling up in recent years, and this is going to be my chance to try to string them together. One of the articles I won't be reading from is called Our Irrational Fear of Forgetting, and it's about the growing fear among many people of developing Alzheimer's, even though only 1/8 people ever develops Alzheimer's. But I think beyond, even short of Alzheimer's, a lot of people have this fear of losing their memory, just getting older and seeing that the memory shrinks, that we don't recall things as well, especially nouns, proper nouns. It is such an overblown kind of thing. I'm just going to dive into this first article I have. It's from NPR. It's a transcription of a short piece on NPR about how forgetting might make us smarter. It's called Could the Best Memory System Be One That Forgets? And this is by June of last year, by Andrea Hsu, H-S-U. She says that in the world of artificial intelligence, there's something called overfitting, a phenomenon in which a machine stores too much information, hindering its ability to behave intelligently. The main point of that being that intelligence is far, far more than memory. She says here, this is an interview of her, I would argue that he mentions encyclopedic memories. She says, I would argue they're not just irrelevant, but they can be detrimental to living our daily lives. She then mentions a case coming from an old study by a Russian clinical neuropsychologist by the name of Luria, L-U-R-I-A, who had a patient who reported that he was able to memorize basically everything from his life. But this patient, S, was actually at a disadvantage because he had trouble identifying the commonalities, the patterns in the world. And these commonalities or patterns are what actually allow us to make intelligent decisions. She continues, our memories ultimately are there to help us make decisions, to act in the world in an intelligent manner. Even though we all get a big kick out of people who can smash a trivia game, evolution doesn't care if you can remember who hit the home run in the 1968 World Series. Evolution cares about whether or not you are an individual who's making appropriate decisions in the environment to maximize your chances of survival and reproduction, of course. And here's a little nugget that I didn't know about. The interviewer says, a lot of people become more forgetful after having a kid. How does this work into your hypotheses? And she says, I actually love the example of after you've had a kid. This is another fascinating piece of forgetting that people, another piece of forgetting that people have speculated on. And let me just clarify that this is me speculating. I don't know if there's scientific evidence for this or not. But if everyone remembered very accurately what childbirth was like, and we all remembered very accurately what having an infant or toddler is like, and I say this as someone who has a toddler, most of us would probably not have more than one kid. So it's actually probably beneficial for us in terms of making the decisions evolution wants us to make, to forget those parts of our lives. And another article, this is from the New York Times of July of last year. It's under this series called Gray Matter, and it's by an Ulrich Boser, Why It's Good to Forget. And she starts off by talking about parents' anxiety about the summer vacation, where their kids might experience learning loss. And she says, a forgotten memory is a lot like an old file on your computer. While the document still exists, you don't have a good way of getting to it. And today, many memory researchers don't even use the word forgetting. The term implies that a recollection is gone forever. Instead, forgetting is a matter of retrieval failure. By the way, according to Buddhist psychology, everything we experience and perceive, everything, every little iota of a detail is filed away in what is called this storehouse consciousness or the alaya vijnana. So that would fit with this thing of not the word forget not being quite right. It's just not accessible. 99% of what we experience moment by moment is we just park it in this alaya vijnana until sometimes it bubbles up during sesshin. And that's where this idea of a storehouse consciousness becomes more and more persuasive, is things that bubble up during sesshin from years, decades ago, that it's all there, it's all here. She continues, besides the occasional memory gaffe, the brain's approach to forgetting serves us well, and our retrieval failures help prune away memories that we don't really need. Or consider living with an unending library of easily recalled memories. It would be overwhelming. Dates, names, phone numbers, they would all be constantly top of mind. And then she quotes a Robert Bjork, a researcher at the University of California, Los Angeles. You don't want everything to be recalled. You want to remember where you parked the car today, not yesterday or a week ago. I went through a period where I would drive about a mile from where I was living. I'd drive a mile to the campus when I was a college student, and then walk all the way back, forgetting that I had parked, I had driven. Where I get out in the morning, where's my car? In this model of forgetting, when we extract a detail from the brain's long-term storage, that detail becomes easier to recall in the future. And then this professor says, to remember something important, you have to keep experiencing it. So if you want to recall where you parked the car today, then practice remembering that specific location. If you want to easily summon the names of state capitals, then make sure to draw regularly on the names of state capitals. Our brain is built to foster this sort of forgetting and remembering, according to a paper released in June in the journal Neuron. In the article, the researchers argue that many of the brain cells associated with memory actively foster memory loss. The growth of new neurons seems to promote forgetting, the researcher Blake Richard said. If you add new neurons, it effectively overwrites memories and erases them. I'm just going to skip over to another article for a minute, called The Older Brain Really May Be a Wiser Brain. This is by Sarah Reistad Long from the New York Times of 2008, actually. And it just starts off, when older people can no longer remember names at a cocktail party, they tend to think that their brain power is declining. But a growing number of studies suggest that this assumption is often wrong. Instead, the research finds the aging brain is simply taking in more data and trying to sift through a clutter of information, often to its long-term benefit. And this is the rest of this comes from a neurology book called Progress in Brain Research. I'll run through one of these experiments. The subjects were asked to read passages that are interrupted with unexpected words or phrases. And adults 60 and older work much more slowly than college students. Although the students plow through the text at a consistent speed, regardless of what the out-of-place words mean, older people slow down even more when the words are related to the topic at hand. That indicates that they are not just stumbling over the extra information, but are taking it in and processing it. When both groups were later asked questions for which the out-of-place words might be answers, the older adults responded much better than the students. And then the author of this said, for the young people, it's as if the distraction never happened. But for older adults, because they've retained all this extra data, they're now suddenly the better problem solvers. They can transfer the information they've soaked up from one situation to another. Such tendencies can yield big advantages in the real world, where it is not always clear what information is important or will become important. A seemingly irrelevant point or suggestion in a memo can take on new meaning if the original plan changes. Or extra details that stole your attention, like others yawning and fidgeting, may help you assess the speaker's real impact. So this is mindfulness, greater mindfulness as you get older, it seems to be saying, where there's more of a panoramic awareness and you're not filtering out as much, but just processing more things that could possibly be useful. And then the quotes, author, a broad attention span may enable older adults to ultimately know more about a situation and the indirect message of what's going on than their younger peers. We believe that this characteristic may play a significant role in why we think of older people as wiser. You know, what springs to mind as I'm reading this is something I have come to appreciate more than I used to about Roshi Kaplow, where I, being close to him for years, I came to notice that he would notice people who were quiet. He would notice the silences or the spaces in things. I think most people would certainly notice particularly loud, disruptive people, extroverted people, but he would see the backside. He would notice the absence of people engaging, the absence of people contributing, and that I think is sort of what they're talking about here. In a 2003 study at Harvard, Dr. Carson and other researchers tested students' ability to tune out irrelevant information when exposed to a barrage of stimuli. The more creative the students were thought to be, determined by a questionnaire on past achievements, the more trouble they had ignoring the unwanted data. A reduced ability to filter and set priorities could contribute to original thinking. Oh, this is getting to creativity. I don't have time for that. There's more here that I have to get back to. So back to this article by this Ulrich Boser, Why It's Good to Forget. Again, many of the brain cells associated with memory actively foster memory loss. The benefits of forgetting go far beyond facts or even brain cells. And when we relearn something that we've forgotten, we often gain deeper forms of insight. Think of Marcel Proust's famous literary bite of a Madeleine, then, as not just a remembrance of things past, but also an effective form of developing expertise. This is what I've noticed in working with people on koans, not just the primary koan, breakthrough koan, but the hundreds of subsequent koans, is the more times I revisit the koan in Doksan with the student, the more depth or texture to the koan I come to appreciate. She continues, to a degree, the value of such forgetting is self-evident, and when people re-engage an area of expertise, they have more perspective. They're better able to spot connections. In much the same way, weak memories can improve understanding. The researchers so-and-so showed that a weak recollection can make it easier for people to solve problems. And this Professor Robertson said, if the memory is too rigid, you can miss the conceptual forest. I long ago came to appreciate the advantage of forgetting. It may have started when I was in Japan and one of the teachers I work with there, Harada Shodo Roshi, said, as you advance on the path, your memory goes. Now, you think about that a little bit. Advancement is usually linked to length, duration of practice. So as you practice for 10, 20, 30 or more years, you're getting older anyway, so your memory is going. But another way to understand it is that Zen practice is a way of letting go. We're training the mind to let go of what we don't need to hold on to. And so, yes, there are inconveniences of forgetting names or other things, but you can compensate for that loss of memory with little mnemonic devices. I'm always writing myself notes, and to me that's a great trade, to be able to forget things that are problematic and I don't need to remember, and just learn to write notes. Or this would be, of course, a good use of digital devices, to instead of writing notes, just record things that you need to remember. Just to go further into this, there's a lot of pain that we can suffer unnecessarily by clinging to memories. So someone says something to you that's rude or disparaging, critical, and Zen practice gives us a way of letting go of it when there's no need to hold on to it. And usually there is no need. Why would you hold on to something like that? Or some bad experience. Let's say you've made a bad investment or other financial decision that's done. There's nothing you can do about it. It's done. And by training in Zen, we learn to to keep our attention in the present rather than dwelling in something painful that is gone, has happened, it's done. This may be why the Albert Schweitzer, the famous humanitarian of the 20th century, he became known throughout the world for his humanitarian work in Africa and other countries. And a reporter asked him, Dr. Schweitzer, what is happiness? And he said, happiness? He thought for a minute. He said, it's nothing more than good health and a poor memory. You forget the slights. You forget the grudges. You forget the conflicts you've had with people. I remember when that first started happening to me and had some kind of a stressful exchange with someone, or someone was getting on my nerves, and then years passed, and I thought back, and I thought, what was that? I don't even remember why I had those bad feelings toward that person. And good, done, let it go. It's a great, great asset of getting older. And that's also wisdom, not dwelling on things of the past, but just taking things as they come. And then there's another article here about, it's called Why Are Memories from Young Adulthood So Strong? And the subtitle is The Mysteriously Memorable 20s. And this is for all you millennials out there. And begin. This is from Slate Magazine of 2013, January 2013. Begins, why do we remember more from young adulthood than from any other time of our lives? What is it about 20-somethings in general? Why are we so fixated on the no man's land between childhood and stable adulthood? And then the article explores different theories as to what this would be. It seems to be pretty well established that this is true, that this what they're calling a reminiscence bump in the 20s. There's something deeply, weirdly meaningful about this period of time. It plays an outsized role in how we structure our expectations, stories, and memories. The basic finding is this: we remember more events from late adolescence and early adulthood than from any other stage of our lives. This is called the reminiscence bump. It says many researchers have been wrestling with this reminiscence bump. Oh, the author's name is Katie Waldman. Since at least the 1980s, when studies began turning up this evidence of memory having a peculiar affinity for events that happened during the third decade of life. They're not still completely sure what causes us to drench those years with special import, whether it's the intrinsic qualities of events that happen within that time frame, a consequence of the way our 20-year-old brains encode information, or a recall strategy that arbitrarily favors milestones from our salad days. Autobiographical memories are not distributed equally across the lifespan. Instead, people tend to experience a period of childhood amnesia between birth and age 5, a reminiscence bump between age 10 and 30, and at any age, a vivid period of recency from the present waning back to the end of the reminiscence bump. Scientists noted that the brain transcribes novel experiences more readily than mundane ones. For instance, a 1988 study found that 93% of vivid life memories concern unique or first-time events. Might the reminiscence bump reflect the fact that late adolescence and early adulthood are suffused with firsts? First relationship, first time leaving home, first job, first marriage, first child. So that's one theory. And then there's another one, an alternate theory about this reminiscence bump, one soaked in what's become known as the narrative perspective. This approach focuses not on the mechanics of memory, but on its underlying motivational factors. It suggests that we organize remembered events in ways that help us understand who we are. In 2002, Bernson and David Rubin advanced a life script account of the reminiscence bump. They defined the life script as a culturally conditioned storyline of events that make up a skeletal life course, and claimed that people often consult such a template when asked to remember their pasts. According to the researchers, the benchmark moments in life scripts, called slots, that is, the benchmark moments are called slots, have two relevant features. They're usually happy, childbirth, there's that forgetting childbirth again, they're usually happy childbirth, one's wedding day, and they occur with greater frequency during one's 20s and late teens. Most of the memories that arise during the reminiscence bump also have a positive valence. Such results would seem to support the idea that our recall strategies depend at least partially on socially inflected hunches about what the typical life entails. And then there's this other one theory called self-defining episodes. It could be that we favor recollections, whatever their emotional charge, that reinforce who we think we are. Integral to this account is the notion that identity and memory are interfused. This is where we get into pure Buddhism. Identity and memory are interfused. Our self-image hangs on the experiences we salvage from the past, and we select certain moments for safekeeping because of how they anchor our self-image. Self-image is another word for ego. Ego is such a problematic word. We used to use it a lot more here in the earlier days of the center. It's just loaded with pejorative ideas. But really, we naturally, all of us, we build up a self-image based on our experiences, and this self-image then is composed of memories and associations and thoughts and ideas about the self. That is what awakening reveals. That is all the self is. It's ideas, concepts, thoughts, memories, associations, images from the past. That's the self. Not that it's completely false. It's only false in any kind of absolute sense. So I've read in more than a few Buddhist books that the Buddha never declared that simply that there is no self. What he said was that there is no absolute self as something standing apart from everything else. That what we call the self is this functional structure from which we work in the world, the way we respond to people. So it's I think most of you know that we to function in a sane way, we need to develop a sense of self as children. We have to have a sense of self and other. We need that as children. But then once we've established that sense of coherence as someone who is indeed different from everyone else, Buddhism doesn't say we're not all different, that we are unique, each one of us, then the worst thing is to operate out of a clinging to that sense of self, those notions, again, memories that we build up. Our self-image, again, our self-image hangs on the experiences we salvage from the past, and we select certain moments for safekeeping because of how they anchor our self-image. If we recall more experiences from young adulthood, perhaps that's because our sense of self glimmers between those early milestones. So then, skipping just a little bit here, this suggests that we remember this reminiscence bump of the 20s, we remember more assiduously during bursts of self-making. And it recounts a study here that showed that a majority of the memories associated with a particular self-image came from the very same year that the self-image developed. It seemed clear that the more salient a past experience was to your identity, the more luminous it grew in your memory. And what turned out to be the median age at which all these traits and self-concepts were acquired? 22.9 years. Insurance companies have always given a break in insurance rates to those who reach the age of 25. Last I heard, it was 25. Neuroscience confirms that the brain is not fully formed or developed until the age of 25. As luck would have it, the part that develops first before age 25 is our impulses, and judgment doesn't catch up to impulses. Hence, the higher insurance rates for people under 25. But it would also indicate that until the brain is fully developed, that this sense of self is not finished. Now, there's another researcher who says also seems persuaded by the identity-based approach to the reminiscence bump. Quote, "The fact is that in this period, one's 20s, you are becoming the person you're going to be," he says. And he describes a study in which researchers found that most movie adaptations and remakes occur exactly 20 years after the originals come out. Apparently, whatever touches people as young adults looms so large for the rest of their lives that when they reach the age at which their generation starts to create the culture, around 40, books and screens fill up with the arcana of 20 years ago. And so this guy says, "So look out for a new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles film any day now." And then I also came across a review of a book by Oliver Sacks, the late Oliver Sacks, who wrote amazing books about about consciousness and all the quirks of consciousness and memory. And in this review by Nicole Krauss, The review is called A Last Glimpse into His Mind, Oliver Sacks' Final Collection of Essays. And she mentions here that Freud himself understood memory as a transforming, reorganizing process, essentially a creative process, in which memories are perpetually revised and recategorized to shape identity and support a sense of continuity as an individual. And something he wrote in 1896, Freud described the brain's action of calling up a memory and revising it in response to fresh circumstances. This has become more and more clear in this century, the 21st century, how much we recreate memories or revise our memories unconsciously. This is most dramatically been proven in cases of people who've been convicted of crimes and then were proven were exonerated, that they could even under heavy cross-examination, they can even come to believe that they did something. They committed the crime, when in fact later DNA evidence proves that they didn't commit the crime, but they will confess to it. One researcher in this field said, all memory is reconstructed memory. I had a very sobering experience of this. I was doing a stint of psychotherapy, and the therapist I was working with was asking me about my relationships with my parents, of course, and I was saying that there were six kids in our family, and I hardly remember a single time when I was alone with either parent, except my father. We worked out in the woods in the back together quite a bit, actually. But aside from working, the only experience I had alone with him was when he took me to Detroit Tigers baseball game when I was 10 years old, which still looms large in my memory because of the rarity of it. But then with my mother, I could only remember one experience where I had been alone with her, and he asked me to elaborate, and I said that one day my mother had vacationed in a small cottage on Lake Michigan, and she was very fond of water and I guess of fishing. So one day, she, at the dinner table, all eight of us there, she said, I want to go fishing. Who will go fishing with me? My father had no interest. He was born on a farm, raised on a farm, and had absolutely no interest in fishing. And no one else was speaking up, so I said, I will. And so she said, okay, you got to get up early. Tomorrow morning, we leave at 5 o'clock. Get out there. And so just to cut to the chase, we went out there, and I explained to my therapist that there we were out in that rowboat in the middle of the lake fishing at dawn, and what a marvelous experience. It's just my mom and me in that boat. And when a couple months later, I was telling my sister Martha about this, and she said, I was there too. And upon further reflection, I realized that she had been there, but I had erased her from my memory. Okay, so again, Freud, the brain's action of calling up a memory and revising it in response to fresh circumstances, as this can happen many times in a life, a memory might be described as having a kind of geological history with different stratifications going back through time, representing the psychic achievement of successive epochs of life. Freud wrote that he had come to explain psychoneuroses, quote, by supposing that this translation has not taken place in the case of some of the material. In other words, that our psychological health depends on our ability to constantly revise and refashion memory to allow for growth and change. In the absence of this process, that is, the stagnation of a memory, the brain's treatment of it as something fixed leads to pathology. The author says, this is an extraordinary insight, one that helped to establish our understanding of the self as flexible rather than static. There it is again, the self as flexible rather than static. Exactly what awakening reveals, that there is no little man inside us or woman inside us, that we are flux, each one of us. Or as we say, as Hakuin says, our true self is no self. So the self is flexible rather than static, and our sense of the past as an imaginative reconstruction, ever evolving, both of which make therapy possible. As a neurologist, Sachs deepened our understanding of the dynamic, creative abilities of the brain by uncovering, again and again, the unusual ways the impaired brain may deal with its handicaps, compensating in ingenious ways, or by creating plausible explanations for the nonsensical, thus preserving a form of coherence, however subjective. Taken together, his case studies illustrated just how, just as homeostasis, the maintenance of constant internal environment, is crucial to our organisms, so is a stable, cogent narrative of reality crucial to the mind and its construction of the self, such that even severely disordered brains will find ways of creating order. Okay, so we need this to have a certain functional level of psychological integration. We need to have a coherent sense of self. But then having established that, we can then move beyond that into this realm of no self, because we've established it. We're grounded in who we are. This is why it is so helpful in practicing Zen to have developed a coherent, integrated, well-adjusted, ideally well-adjusted sense of self. Then we can move beyond it. Mentions here that neither psychoanalysis nor brain imaging can tell the difference between a true and false memory. This is so sobering that we can't entirely trust our memories. And more than that, Sachs writes, there is, it seems, no mechanism in the mind or the brain for ensuring the truth. We have no direct access to historical truth. No way by which the events of the world can be directly transmitted or recorded in our brains. They are experienced and constructed in a highly subjective way. Our only truth is narrative truth, the stories we tell each other and ourselves, the stories we continually recategorize and refine. Again, this is solid Buddhist teaching, that what we think of as reality is our construction of reality, our interpretation of it. It can vary from person to person. I'm going to take just one more article here. It's about the difficulty of remembering jokes. I can't be the only one who has trouble remembering jokes. And this is from another New York Times article of 2009. It's called In One Ear and Out the Other by Natalie Angier. And then she just sketches out the basic working of the memory. We have a short-term working memory of limited scope and fast turnover rate. And we have our equivalent of a save button. The hippocampus, deep in the forebrain, is essential for translating short-term memories into a more permanent form. Our frontal lobes perform the find function, retrieving saved files to embellish as needed. And though scientists used to believe that short and long-term memories were stored in different parts of the brain, they have discovered that what really distinguishes the lasting from the transient is how strongly the memory is engraved in the brain and the thickness and complexity of the connections linking large populations of brain cells. The deeper the memory, the more readily and robustly an ensemble of like-minded neurons will fire. This process of memory formation by neuronal entrainment helps explain why some of life's offerings weasel in easily and then refuse to be spiked. Music, for example. A professor of music and neuroscience, Michael Thaut, Thaut, says the brain has a strong propensity to organize information and perception in patterns, and music plays into that inclination. And so the author says this is why a simple melody with a simple rhythm and repetition can be a tremendous mnemonic device. This doctor says it would be a virtually impossible task for young children to memorize a sequence of 26 separate letters if you just gave it to them as a string of information. But when the alphabet is set to the tune of the ABC song with its four melodic phrases, preschoolers can learn it with ease. And then, really great jokes, on the other hand, punch the lights out of Do Re Mi. They work not by conforming to pattern recognition routines, but by subverting them. Jokes work because they deal with the unexpected, starting in one direction and then veering off into another, said Robert Provein, a professor of psychology, University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and the author of Laughter, a Scientific Investigation. What makes a joke successful are the same properties that can make it difficult to remember. This may also explain why the jokes we tend to remember are often the most cliched ones. A mother-in-law joke? Yes, I have the slot ready and labeled. Memory researchers suggest additional reasons that great jokes may elude common capture. There's a big difference between a verbatim recall of all details of an event and gist recall of its general meaning. He says, we humans are pretty good at gist recall, but have difficulty with being exact. And then the author says, though anecdotes can be told in broad outline, jokes live or die by nuance, precision, and timing. And while emotional arousal normally enhances memory, it ends up further eroding your attention to that one killer frill. Emotionally arousing material calls your attention to a central object, Dr. Schachter said, but it can make it difficult to remember peripheral details. And then he also talks about infectious amnesia. So you ask friends for help, you set off so-called infectious amnesia. Behind the tying up of tongues are two delicate nerves, T-O-O, two delicate nerves of our brain's frontal lobes and their sensitivity to anxiety and the hormones of fight or flight. The frontal lobes that rifle through stored memories and perform other higher cognitive tasks tend to shut down when the lower brain senses danger and demands that energy be shunted its way. So in other words, you're caught, you're stuck trying to remember a name, and you turn to someone next to you. What was the name of that movie, that person? And then it's remarkable how often it happens that that person you're turning to also forgets it. And they say because of just some very subtle sense of anxiety about being turned to and relied on to remember something. And the anxiety interferes with the memory. I'm going to close with a joke, one of the few jokes I do remember. about two couples, two married couples, getting on in age, who are sitting and one couple came over to the others for dinner, and they have an enjoyable dinner, and they end up chatting in the living room, and then the wives get up and go to the kitchen to start getting the dessert or something. It's kind of a dated joke, but all right. So the husbands are left alone, and then in chatting, the one husband starts raving about this restaurant that he and his wife had gone to, and he says, it goes, the food is just exquisite, the service was impeccable, and the decor, it was a big, fantastically beautiful place. And finally, the other guy says, well, what's the name of the restaurant? And the first guy who's talking about it, he pauses, he looks over toward the kitchen with his face frowning, he pauses, and he says, what's the name of that red flower with the thorns? And the other guy says, Rose. And then the first guy turns and he says, hey, Rose, what's the name of that restaurant? All right, we'll stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha, and bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain.